The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, Chanel Miller, the victim of an assault on the Stanford University campus, joined us to chat about reclaiming her identity. She shared her story of the aftermath of the assault and trial on which her aptly titled book, Know My Name, is based. Former Judge Gillian Hussey joined us at 14 Henrietta Street, where she shared stories from the bench and the most memorable cases she presided over. Iconic comedian and storyteller Billy Connolly brought his famous sharp wit while being as entertaining and inspiring as ever when he joined us to chat about his new book, Tall Tales and Wee Stories. Screenwriter Paul Laverty gave us an intriguing perspective on the failings of the modern world while discussing his latest film, Sorry We Missed You, about the economic injustice experienced by those working in the gig economy. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoyed. Until next time, thanks for listening. After she was sexually assaulted on the Stanford University campus while unconscious, my next guest's life split in two. She became known as Emily Doe, and her assailant served just 3 months in prison. Now she's ready to tell the world who she really is. Today, Chanel Miller reclaims her identity as she shares her story and the aftermath of the assault and trial that followed in her new book, aptly titled Know My Name. Chanel, a very good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Chanel, let me ask you a question that I probably wouldn't have asked somebody in your position some time ago, even in the last 2 or 3 years, and that is this: are you comfortable talking now about this moment in your life? Are you okay talking about it, or do you fear the triggering of memory?
No, I've actually discovered something quite wonderful, which is that when I would testify during trial, each time the moment in the hospital, waking up in the hospital after the assault was brought up, I would lose complete control over my emotions. I'd begin hyperventilating, I wouldn't be able to see straight, and I'd basically give in to crying until they realized they couldn't go on with questioning and I would be excused to collect myself in the bathroom. That's what happened every time. Now I find that I can remain composed, that I have a very fact-based understanding and grasp of what happened, and I actually get more choked up speaking about what the support and reaction has felt like, because that has been so moving to me. Basically, over the course of processing this, my emotional center has shifted, and I'm really touched by the love I continue to feel, you know, having lived through this assault.
Okay, well then, with that in mind, let's talk about the assault. And I suppose it just puts everything in context. It puts your story in context. It puts your life in context. It puts our conversation in context. So with your permission, maybe take us through as much as you can in a way that you're not uncomfortable with. What happened to you? It was 2015. You were 22 years old and you had graduated already from university. But take us through as much as you can that night.
Sure. I was living at home with my parents. Stanford University is very close by. I had grown up sort of going to that campus for summer camps and lectures, so it felt very familiar to me. My sister, my younger sister, who was in college at the time, was home for the weekend, invited me to this fraternity party with her friends. I decided to go. I thought it would be a very silly event. I'd be the oldest person present, and we went and we were dancing. I was making all these silly, like, juice concoctions. I was dancing like a piece of seaweed. We were having a fantastic time, and I was drinking a lot of hard alcohol with complete disregard for how drunk I was getting, just sort of lost in all of it. And the next thing I know, I wake up in a hospital. It's extremely bright. I have dried blood and bandages on the backs of my hands, and I'm in a gurney. And I turn and see a deputy and a dean of students who come over to me, and the deputy leans over and he says, "We have reason to believe you've been sexually assaulted." To me, he seemed so grave. I thought, they surely have the wrong person. You know, I was just at this ridiculous party with my sister, and I'd really just prefer to go home, but, you know, thanks for letting me sleep it off here. And I was ready to be released, but, you know, they insisted that I get a rape kit done. So I was taken to another room where I had this invasive exam done for the next few hours. And I went to the restroom and discovered my underwear was missing. I had no recall of what had happened. I didn't understand why it was gone. And then next thing you know, they're giving me the morning after pill. They're testing me for multiple STDs. They're prodding me with all these medical devices. I had to strip fully naked. They took photos of my body, which would later be projected in court. And my hair was completely embedded with pine needles. I could not make sense of that. I didn't understand how all of these leaves and scratchy pieces of debris had been stuck inside my hair. And so none of these things were piecing together. And the only thing I was told that morning was that I had been found behind a dumpster and somebody had been caught and arrested. But I didn't understand, you know, why he was caught. I didn't understand why he had run from the scene. And that was never relayed to me.
It is extraordinary because you were going through the demanding motions of what happens to a victim of such a crime.
It's, yes.
You recall it like it sounds like it's surreal, like you're almost in a movie, in an out-of-body experience in some ways.
Absolutely. I was completely disconnected from it.
And then my next question is this, and it strikes me as though here you are being given all this information, being tested for all these things, and yet oblivious as to what exactly had happened to you. So you had this very peculiar jigsaw pieces that you had to put together bit by bit. How did you do that, memory-wise?
I did not. I sort of blocked it out, and I figured if I just continue to nod my head and agree to everything they're asking of me, they're going to take care of everything, and I'm going to be set right and sent home. And so that's what I did, and I was sent home. And for the next 10 days, I was not contacted by a single person. So I thought, okay, maybe nothing happened. You know, maybe they were just taking every precaution and, you know, nothing had transpired. So I went back to work. I was sort of in denial that I had ever even been to the hospital. And 10 days later, I'm sitting at my desk at work and the headline appears that, you know, this unconscious, intoxicated, half-naked, one breast exposed body was found behind a dumpster and the assailant had admitted to digitally penetrating me, to groping me. He denied running away. At the same time, he said that I enjoyed it, even though he was not able to recall who I was or what I looked like. And reading that I took pleasure in this, at the same time, I was processing that my body had been found so exposed, was something that I could not stomach, was something that was so incredibly suffocating and would be for a really long time.
And on it went, the news reports would come out and you were trying to figure out, so this was me, and you're looking mm-hmm. at reports and you're reading things going, what, who? And they've arrested somebody. I was in Stanford University, which is one of the most esteemed campuses in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And for this to happen, people feel it's otherworldly. It's not the sort of thing that would happen there, et cetera, et cetera. And the name Brock Turner was mentioned. Did you know anything about him? Did you look him up? Did you investigate further?
No, I knew nothing about him. Seeing his photo accompanying, you know, the reports of my assault was the first time I had seen him. And still to this day, I don't really know him. He was just a silent person in the courtroom throughout trial. So it deeply disturbed me that this stranger was claiming, you know, that we had some sort of, you know, friendly hitting off that night, that we had been conversing, that this was a loving interaction. It was a heat of the moment, passion type thing, when really he had no idea who I was or what I was capable of.
And now that you know the details, can you piece it back a little bit together? If we go back a couple of steps, what happened to you that night? What did he do and how were you discovered? And can you give us that sense of the evening in question now that you have the details?
Sure. My sister had briefly left to take care of a friend, so I was by myself at this party. The phone logs indicate that I had been calling my boyfriend repeatedly. I had called my other friend. I had called my sister. So I was trying to figure out where they were. Then there's a period of time where he finds me. He takes me away from the party under his arm. We walk away from the party. He claimed that I slipped and pulled him down on top of me. That's why we were on the ground. He then proceeded to remove my underwear, digitally penetrate me, and two Swedish graduate students happened to be passing by on bicycles. They noticed that he was thrusting a body that did not seem to be moving, so I was unconscious with my eyes closed. They immediately jumped into action. They confronted him, said, "What the F are you doing?" He took off running. One of the Swedish graduate students kneeled down to check that I was breathing. The other one took off, did a leg sweep, tackled Brock, pinned him down, and he was yelling, "Do you think this is okay? What the F are you doing?" And saying, "Apologize to her, apologize to her." And Brock was trying to get away, so the other Swede came, and the two of them mounted him, pinned down his every limb, and made sure that I got medical attention. So even when you have a case as clear as that, where two sober, unbiased witnesses understand the situation immediately, and even when you have Brock who ran, which exhibits consciousness of guilt, I still had to undergo a year and a half of extremely emotionally damaging court proceedings, a 2.5-week trial, to ultimately end up with a 6-month county jail sentencing for the 3 felonies of sexual assault and intent to rape that Brock was convicted of.
The court proceedings, as you've just mentioned them, seem to cover a lot of things other than the crime of rape. Do you know what I mean by that? It seemed to cover talk of consent, of alcohol abuse, if you like. And it seemed that the fingers were pointing in the wrong direction vis-a-vis culpability.
Correct.
And can you tell me about that? I mean, did you find yourself going, why are you asking? Because they had to, in some ways, a defense attorney needs to reduce you in the eyes of a jury, emotionally, physically, whatever it might be, intellectually. Is that what happened in this case?
Absolutely. In court, you feel completely stripped of identity. You feel constantly exposed. When you try to give testimony, you're constantly interrupted with objections. The defense is there to remind the jury of how much you drank. He asks you how much you drank in college. You know, how many times have you blacked out? As if this is relevant to this case in which the perpetrator made a decision to violate my body. And so often we use alcohol to blame the victim and dismiss violence and rationalize violence and make excuses for the perpetrator, when really, I don't care how drunk you are. It is never okay for somebody to hurt you. It is never okay for someone to touch you without your permission. And the suggestion that, you know, that I had been reckless, that meant that I deserved this, would never be true. And, you know, since I did not have memory, I watched as Brock sort of filled in the testimony and, you know, took every liberty to fill in that story, to paint it how he wanted it to be seen. You know, that night after he was arrested, he never mentioned that there was any dialogue between us. And during trial, he was on the stand and they asked him if there had been consent, and he claimed that he had literally asked if he could finger me and that I had explicitly said yes. All of this seemed to come out of nowhere. And so in a courtroom where you think people are bound to the truth, I watched so many things get distorted while I was overridden and silenced.
And were you slightly hamstrung in any way, Chanel, by the fact that you had blocked out, and that if he's, that he, the cards were in his hand, so he could say this happened, this happened, this happened, and then you weren't in a great position to say it didn't. I'm not having a go at you by any means, but I'm just asking you about the process.
Yeah, you feel like, oh, well, maybe, you know, I didn't defend myself properly, when really, at the end of the day, I was not assaulted because I had too much whiskey. I was assaulted because he made a decision that night to assault me, and that will forever be the case. And it's very fascinating to me that, you know, immediately when I was interviewed by the detective, I was transparent about how much I had had to drink. I laid it all on the table. I was never, you know, trying to hide any of it. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, I threw back these shots. I did it without chaser. I don't know what I was doing. And I felt like crap the next day. But you don't have to tell a victim, oh, maybe you should drink less. Trust me, she knows this. You need to tell the perpetrator, you don't get to touch her. I don't care about the circumstances. That is never, ever your right.
The perpetrator, Brock Turner, the media seemed to have a kind of peculiar fascination with him, his status, if you like, in society. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, he was operating under an immense amount of privilege, which to me means never having to examine yourself, never having to step back and think about what your actions mean to other people, to be so insulated in your own experience, to never have to think about what it would mean for me. And I think it's interesting that in the criminal justice system, you know, when you have a perpetrator who's a person of color, they're more likely to be demonized, to be seen as dangerous, to be labeled as a criminal. Whereas for him, he was so humanized. We treated this as, oh, this was just a slip up in behavior, that this was just a lapse in judgment, but it's not who he is. He's still, at the end of the day, a model citizen who lost his way and needs some guidance back. But I watched this protection around him as the court proceedings happened, and this deepening of empathy for all of his losses of status, for not being able to attend Stanford, for not being able to be on the swimming team. And meanwhile, I was sort of this side character. I was nothing more than the body that was found behind the dumpster. So my inability to exist as a person and his ability to exist as a full human who, you know, has hopes and dreams, who has childhood memories, who has so much at stake, that juxtaposition was stunning to me.
I just want to mention it as you're talking, the fact that your book, by no accident, I suspect, and by total design, has this black and white design. You know, the top half is black backdrop to the white words, know my name, and then there you are, your name in black print, Chanel Miller, on a white backdrop. And I'm thinking then, of course, of the resurrection of the case of the Central Park case all those years ago, which is now in the TV show Now You See Us. And it brings up that sense of the judicial system and the black and white factor. And race, in some ways. You think we would evolve as a species, but it seems we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, we're a little slow.
We're a little slow at that point. You were Emily Doe. Isn't that what the name they gave you as the anonymous figure in the courthouse and the courtroom? I'm just, at what point do you decide? I mean, is it an epiphany? Is it a cathartic moment where you say, I am sick of being in the shadow. I'm not the body at the dumpster. I am a human being. And I won't be out-humaned or humanized by the guy who did this to me. Was that a process or a moment?
Definitely a process, because you fear that you will be branded, right? That this will overshadow the rest of your life, that you will never be able to build yourself beyond this act of violence, and that you will forever be trapped in that story. And for a while, I was so bitter. I had just graduated. I felt like I had my whole life ahead of me. Mm. And now I felt like I was stuck in this case, that I could never be anything more. And that was really terrifying sometimes, that sense of hopelessness, of not being able to be who you want to be in the world. And I think as I was writing, I was beginning to realize, as I came to the end of writing the book, that when you look back, the experience of this assault is major and it's formative. At the same time, it is only one of so many experiences in my life, and being able to incorporate it into the rest of my life was really healing. I think I've finally accepted, fine, you know, this will be a huge part of my life and how the public knows me, but I get to decide what role it plays. I get to decide who I am in this case. So now I emerge as an author. I emerge as someone who refuses to be silent and has, as a result of going through this, is now more assertive and more confident that I'm not just emotionally damaged and this broken person, that I have figured out how to grow and fill myself out as a human, and also make sure that we continue to humanize survivors, to say we are not just statistics, we are not the nameless, anonymous Emily and Jane Doe's in these cases. We are people surrounded by people who love us, and we have our own desires and talents. We have so much to offer, and it infuriates me when we let that get suppressed, when we let victims go off into their corners to mull over the things they did wrong, to dwell in their shame, and we don't do enough to rescue them from that, to say, no, you deserve a full life. You deserve to be right here, and we will fight for you as you find your way back to living.
Let me light on a word you use there, because it's swimming in my head in light of a few interviews we've done on this program and on a TV show recently with people who are victims of the most heinous crimes, mostly sexual crimes. And the feeling is, when they talk in the way you've been talking to us today, Chanel, is that shame belongs to the perpetrator. But for far too long, the victim feels that. And ultimately, the only answer to this, in a psychological, metaphorical sense, is that every victim of a crime like this needs to hold a mirror and reflect that shame right back on the person who committed the crime, because otherwise it's not fair.
Exactly. There's a point where I hope you say, it's not my turn to carry this burden anymore. Yeah. It's your damn turn, right? And so often shame is ingested. It is taught throughout the criminal justice system. You know, I learned so much about having shame about all different parts of my life, and you let it fester, you let it sit there and grow and eat you from the inside out. And we need to be able to extract that from survivors and say, no, this is not yours to carry. This should have never happened to you.
You say the shame loves growing in a contained environment.
Yeah.
Like a tomato in a glass house. But but the key to that is, bring some stones in your pocket and break the glass.
I've never heard any of these metaphors.
I just made it up.
Really,
but it just feels right as if we're talking.
Shame is like moldy tomatoes in a glass house. Something about stones in your pocket.
Stones in your pocket. Break the windows. And again, let it out.
I love that.
You know, it's not right.
That's right. We're giving people stones as we continue to speak.
It's true. You're arming the people who shouldn't be in the glass house. Now, it's going to get out of control, this metaphor, so I'll stop now. But you know where I'm coming from, don't you? You know where I'm coming from. You said you get to use your anger as fuel. Would you rather have less anger Or and if so, does that mean you have less fuel, or can you transplant the anger and put something else there instead?
Oh, no. I think anger can be really wonderful. I think more of us should be mad. When you see someone you love crumble from something like this, when you watch this bright person who was previously so excited about the world begin to withdraw, I want you to boil. I want you to say, I will not allow this to happen. You know, you deserve so much love and safety in your life, and I will use anger to fight for that. You know, I think the anger in the beginning was crippling because I couldn't do anything about it. But I also realized, like, for so long in the beginning, I was basically mute. I couldn't talk about my story, and I kept everything so suppressed. As the case went on, as I began to feel more and more anger, as I began to see what the case was doing to my younger sister, who was forced to be cross-examined on the stand, who was also attacked, anger was a sign that I was finally stepping onto my own side. You know, that I was finally drawing a line, that I did have personal boundaries, and it was not okay that they were being crossed. So anger was that little flame that let me know that I wasn't just going to wither away. It's what was going to bring me back as a person and allow me to begin fighting again. So even, you know, for each interview I go into, I remember, you know, someone I know who has been hurt by this. I feel that little, you know, match striking of anger. And that's how I carry myself and get through and remind myself of purpose.
Where's Brock Turner today, Chanel?
I have no idea, but I know that he, you know, finished probation after 3 years, only served 3 months in the county jail. And, you know, I continue to focus on my own trajectory and remind myself that I'm here to help others, that this is not some revenge, whatever. I think people think, oh, she's coming forward in order to go after him, when really that purpose would never get you anywhere. It would never, I could never conjure enough energy just to get back at him. I have to be here to fight for others, to protect others. And for him, I guess I just wish that he will one day choose to really hear what's happening, to really reflect on it, to grow from it. Life is really long, and to live in your own deluded bubble, to, you know, to never acknowledge harm you've caused, that has to hurt him too in some way. So I don't know, one day.
The Swedish students who pinned him down and got him off you and rescued the moment. There's three words you've used in your book and or in conversations in recent times that I love, because I think for men in particular, whether it's on campus, it's on the street or in the home, be the Swede.
Be the Swede.
Be the Swede. Stop it. Talk about it. Report it. But don't walk past it.
Totally. Confront it. You know, if you see someone being disrespected or hurt or devalued, say something. If you're silent, that's your own stance, you know. That's choosing not to do anything. So
silence makes you complicit.
Exactly.
I think. I mean, especially in terms of what we've been discussing today. It's no longer good enough to be silent or to be passive.
Correct.
So you started off life as Chanel Miller. And your name and your identity was effectively robbed from you from this incident. And you became a shadowy figure called Emily Doe. Yeah. And then you went through hell and you came out the other side. Is it safe and fair to say that Chanel Miller is alive and well?
Oh, yes, And I have so much to continue to enjoy in my life and give and create. And I really look forward to that. And I'm very proud of myself for having been through it all. And I just feel grateful for all the people I continue to meet. And I'm proud of fellow survivors for wherever they are in their journey. I'm proud of you if you get up in the morning and drink enough water. That, to me, is strength. So keep going wherever you are.
Chanel, thank you for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Important book you've written, and appreciate it.
Thank you, Ryan. It was lovely speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Chanel Miller is the author of Know My Name, which is a book for some of us, but a manual for others, I have no doubt. And it's a book you'll want to read. Right, the text number is always 51551. Billy Connolly, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you doing over there?
I'm pretty good, Ryan. The sun's blazing down. I've got no complaints.
Well, you're missing a very Celtic, leafy, autumn, sunny, crisp day in Ireland. I don't know if you're missing it, but just to tell you, to swap weather stories, that's what's happening here.
You're welcome to it.
Yeah. It's funny. Yesterday, I was in Dublin and I was doing a show from a beautiful house in a place called Henrietta Street. It used to be a tenement, and sitting among the crowd was Ronnie Drew's son, Phelim. And I was thinking, Phelim Drew's dad, Ronnie, would have loved to have spoken to you today. You knew him, didn't you?
I was a great friend of his.
And
he was a great hero of mine.
Yeah, tell me about him.
I loved the way he sang. Nobody sang like Ronnie Drew. But also his view on life was pretty good.
Yeah.
He was a lovely man.
Didn't you record a song together?
Yes, we did. It's called Sergeant, Where's Mine? It was an anti-recruiting, army recruiting song.
And you would have been pretty well matched with some of the hairy banjo players in that band anyway.
Absolutely. They were a lovely hairy band. I remember the first time I saw them in Glasgow. I couldn't believe it. They looked like dwarves when they came out on the stage.
It was the Glasgow City Hall in the 60s. Is that when you saw them first?
That's right. Oh, that's right. I remember they did Rose and Jew. It changed my life.
Well, there's one man standing from the Dubliners. His name is John Sheehan. And we had a big, big Late Late Show special for him last year. And I tell you what, he's what you'd call a national treasure. A wonderful man, still playing.
He's a wonderful guy. And his knowledge of poetry is amazing.
Yeah, for sure. I'm only asking you a little bit about your Irish background, Billy, because your book Tall Tales and Wee Stories weaves in and out of your life through different anecdotes and stories. And we have to go back a few greats now, a great, 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 to get to Charles Mills and Bartholomew Valentine Connolly. And we're going to Connemara, the beautiful Connemara in the west coast of Ireland.
Yes, I visited there. I don't know, I didn't meet anybody from my family line, but I visited all the places. It was lovely.
Do you think you got any of your storytelling ability from the west coast of Ireland, or do you attribute it purely to the mean streets of Scotland and Glasgow?
I think it was Glasgow, but the Irish influence in my family was huge, and so I suppose it rubbed off. I always loved the way they spoke. The entertainment in their conversation was lovely.
The other person I want to mention, Billy, is because you not too long ago you had been in Dublin, probably 6-7 years ago, and Shay Healy, one other great favourite of ours, asked you to do something for him, and suddenly your lives were interconnecting for all the most peculiar reasons, really.
It was remarkable. He asked me to do a publicity thing for the Parkinson Society.
Mm.
And he had done it because I made my name on the Parkinson show in England. And we posed for pictures and did this Parkinson thing. And a month later, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's. So I've always blamed him of giving me it.
Well, he'll appreciate the humour in that, I'm sure. When you were diagnosed first, were you scared or were you stoical?
I was pretty stoical because I was diagnosed with cancer the same day.
Only you could laugh like a drain about that, yeah.
It wasn't a good day.
What do you do at the end of a day like that?
That was the weekend I got hearing aids as well.
So let's itemise that. Parkinson's, cancer and hearing aids in the course of a couple of days. How do you process that?
Absolutely. I was kind of confused and bewildered. I wondered what I'd done to deserve it. But it all worked out at the end.
You've said in the past, you said, Billy, you get slyer as you get older. What does that mean?
I get sneakier.
How?
I think people see it as wisdom, but you just get sneakier.
And what are you being sneaky about, and how do you practice the sneakiness?
Well, it's hard to give you examples, but it's you get slyer as you get older. And instead of kicking up a fuss about getting what you want, you find quiet ways to defy people.
How are you feeling these days? How's your health? I'll ask you straight out. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Even as we speak, my left hand is shaking. But I forgot to take my medicine this morning. But the medications I'm on are doing me great good.
You said once upon a time, not too long ago, I don't find it healthy to swim in Parkinson's. Could you kind of explain that a little bit to us?
I don't know what it means.
I presume it means...
I don't absorb myself in it. I don't go to Parkinson Society meetings and talk about it.
Yeah.
It becomes overwhelming and very easily. They're very sociable, the Parkinson's people. They have a great social circuit where they all gather without me.
You just don't want to get involved in that sort of thing, is that it?
I don't want to think about it all the time.
I can understand that entirely.
Like I don't want to look at people who are worse off than me and think, oh, I'm going to be like that. So I avoid it.
Writing your book, you've said that you've resisted ever writing down your tall tales and wee stories, and you added you couldn't quite bear to look at your own words on the page. Why not?
In case they didn't find them funny. They came as ad-libs and grew and grew and grew. I would ad-lib and add to it as the nights went on. I would add and add and add, and it would become something different from the way it started out. And then I would change and drop it and do other stuff. But when it came to the book, the publishers took it from my tapes, and because I didn't have any written information on it, I never wrote it down.
And were you one of those performers, Billy, who just ran to the stage with excitement, or did you stumble up to the stage dreading it?
Well, I did the dreading thing in the dressing room, and the walk from the side of the stage to the microphone, I changed and got to like it. It was a remarkable thing. I've often phoned home and saying, I can't go on, I've got no ideas, I don't know what to say. Make my family feel terrible and then walk on and have the time of my life. It's very weird.
It is weird, but
that walk from the wings to the microphone, you change completely.
And you transform into somebody comfortable and in charge and on fire.
Absolutely. Your voice gets a kind of changes pitch, and it sort of goes up a little notch, and the atmosphere that the audience gives you enables you to start and go on with it. It's a remarkable thing.
The way you speak, it reminds me of a friend of ours who's quite shy to meet in real life, and as soon as he goes on stage, it's like he's transformed. I'm talking about Christy Moore.
Oh, yeah. Christy's a great example of that. Tommy Tiernan is the same. He's a quiet, nice, wise guy, and then when he goes on stage, he becomes this crazy animal.
Did you find you were a better performer when you were drinking?
No. I didn't find much change in my performance from when I stopped drinking, because I never drank before going on stage. Always after. I finished very bravely with drink into the night. So it didn't really affect the way I did my show.
And do you miss it?
My wife would disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm sure she would. I'll talk to her. We spoke to her once before. We might do that again and compare notes. But do you miss that, Billy? Do you miss the stage, the light on you, the microphone, the storytelling in that sense?
I don't yet. I don't have any pangs at all. I don't miss it. I kind of miss the travelling and being in different towns and wandering around. I used to love wandering around people's towns before going on stage at night. Mm. I miss that.
You know, when you talk to people down through the years, say in the 70s and 80s, when your career was just getting bigger and bigger, and you hide away a lot of problems, and that was the done thing then. Now everyone's very much about speaking about their lives, wearing them on their sleeves and so on. You had a lot of secrets that you had to keep buried away. Do you feel that you've been liberated from all of that now at the age you are, that harshness you had to endure as a youngster and as a young person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got rid of it by talking about it. I just unleashed it on the public and there's theirs to deal with now. But I'm glad I did it. It was especially the forgiveness part. You know, when you forgive the people for what they did to you, it releases you.
Because we've been talking on this programme and on the TV to a lot of people who were in a similar boat to you as a kid, when you were a child. And they always, unfortunately, a lot of them still, even in their, these people are younger, they're in their 30s and 40s, they still carry the shame. What would you say to them about that?
The shame has nothing to do with you. You're not to blame, you're the victim. But try the forgiveness. Try and forgive the person for what they did to you. It's remarkable. Even if they're dead, it doesn't matter.
What does the forgiveness do to you, to your heart, your shoulders, your head?
You can lift your head up. It releases you completely, especially from the shame. Because people get kind of upset by the fact that they've taken part in it. And that's what brings the shame.
And, of course, these people were forced into these situations. They weren't consenting participants at all.
Absolutely. It's very weird. It's very complex.
It seems to me, Billy, down through the years, that your marriage to Pam was a game changer. And you've said as much. You said marriage to Pam didn't change me. It saved me. How did it save you?
It's great. She told me the truth. I remember once she said, "I don't mind you drinking, but you drink such crap." and I began to look at the way I drank. And then I stopped drinking altogether. She just put it on the line.
Your own family, you've got grandchildren now?
Yeah, I've got two grandchildren.
You said something lovely that resonated with me, but I presume with most of our listeners this morning, especially given that you're talking to Ireland. You said all fathers should go fishing with their sons. Could you explain that lovely piece of advice?
Oh, yeah. I got it from my son, really. He was interviewed by a fishing magazine and said, "How do you feel about going fishing with your father?" And he said, "Everybody should go fishing with their dad because fishing takes such a long time. Do you get to the place you're going to fish, then the fishing, then the getting back?" He said, "So the daddy stuff," he said, "lasts about an hour. And after that, you have to talk. You have to talk about everything. And it releases you. You get to speak and be honest with your dad. And you become your friend." So Jamie and I are pals. Though he's still my son, I'm still his dad. There's a part of him that's my pal. And it's worked out great.
And he was in recovery not too long ago. And you said that there was a lack of understanding and compassion shown towards addicts. Do you still believe that, Billy, or has that changed?
I think that's changed greatly. Jamie's been sober for 26 years. And so over that time, it has changed radically. Everything has changed. There's a revolution going on in the sexual department as well. You know, all that stuff about transsexuals and bisexuals. And people are so much more tolerant now. Now people go on talk shows and they say I'm gay and the audience bursts into applause. I never thought I'd see that in my life.
And that's not just in the, you know, west coast of America. This has moved right over to Europe, broadly speaking, but in this country, in Ireland, very much so. And in your own hometown of Britain and Scotland, it's all changed utterly.
Radically. It's amazing. It's changed comedy. So now, you used to be able to be funny about gay people and all that. You can't do it anymore. I think it's a very positive development. And you can't speak about women the way... When I started in comedy, people were always talking about their wives who were so stupid and the mother-in-law was such a bat from hell. You don't do that anymore. And comedy's by far the better for it.
You know, the Scottish Nationalist Party are meeting this week and Nicola Sturgeon and her friends are gathering to talk about Brexit and everything else. Now you're probably sitting somewhere very beautiful and thinking about nothing like that. But does your eye ever cast itself across the newspapers? Do you ever think about Brexit? Do you care?
I care, but to a degree. I have great trouble understanding Brexit.
Yeah.
The people who got us into this position were such liars that I can't take it seriously.
How do you feel about Boris Johnson as Prime Minister?
Oh, Boris Johnson, Jesus. Don't start me.
Go on. Give us a flavour of what's in your mind, Billy.
He's just a big, eaten, spoiled brat. He hasn't a clue about the people. Doesn't care. He was one of the liars.
You know, I often say, and I've been saying it to different people, particularly from the UK, that Brexit was voted in by the majority of British people, etc., etc. I mean, do you contend that they didn't know what they were voting for? Is that where you're coming from?
That's where I'm coming from. They were lied to on a grand scale. There should be another referendum.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Do you feel in the States, for comedians particularly, that mocking Donald Trump is it just a little easy?
It's massive. The mocking of Donald Trump is huge. And he sort of rides it like a surfer. It makes his followers stronger.
And do you think it's kind of lazy comedy now at this stage?
No, some of it is brilliant. Some of it is extraordinary. It's anything but lazy, but there's so much of it around.
And in terms of yourself and the future, Billy, what's the plan? I mean, you've this book that everyone's going to love because it's like a literary version of what you've been saying and doing in the last 30, 40 years nearly. Where are you at in life now?
I'm sitting on the beach. I'm doing good. I go fishing and I draw and I watch the television.
And what do you like to draw?
Well, that's kind of weird. I draw strange things. I draw people with blindfolds on, and that's kind of weird to describe.
That's okay. That's okay. That's what you do on the beach in Florida. And we could see some of the drawings in the book, obviously. And what about travel and coming across the water, maybe going back to Glasgow or coming home to, I say home to Dublin, coming to visit Dublin? Are you still in a position that you'd like to travel, or are you happy to stay put now for the foreseeable?
I'm happy to stay put for the foreseeable future. I will always travel, you know, but to a much lesser degree.
Would you describe yourself as happy?
Oh, yeah. If you change happy to content, you'll find that you're happier than you thought you were.
That'll do nicely. That's a nice way to end our conversation. Billy, what a pleasure to talk to you from Dublin to Florida this morning. I wish you the best of luck and good health, and thank you for your time and congratulations on the new book. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely talking to you, Ryan.
Take it easy. Bye for now, Billy.
Bye-bye.
That's Billy Connolly joining us from Florida Surmer, as we don't say, and his new book is called Tall Tales and Wee Stories, and he is one of those iconic comedians and figures in popular culture from the last 40 years and has always been a dear friend of Ireland's, and it's good to talk to him this morning, and we appreciate his time. Billy Connolly, Tall Tales and Wee Stories. The text number is always 51551. Well, as we're here on Henrietta Street in the shadows of the King's Inns, and not far, excuse me, from the forecourt and all things legal, we're joined by one former solicitor and retired judge, Gillian Hussey. Good morning, Gillian. It's lovely to see you again.
Good morning.
Do you have memories of Henrietta Street and passing up and down?
Well, I would actually possibly need binoculars. I'm just looking around the room here,
yes.
And I see I'm by far the oldest person here, and most of the people who lived on the street who are here today weren't born when I used to go up and down this street.
Okay, but you do recall it then, in that sense.
I do recall it. Yeah. I recall it as coming from a very ordinary middle-class family, convent educated.
In Wexford?
Well, I was born in Wexford, but I lived most of my life in Dublin.
Okay.
I'm bi-national. When it suits.
When it suits, I get it.
Yes, yes, of course. But I do remember coming up and down here. I only remember coming up here when the sun was shining, oddly enough. I don't ask me why.
Here it is again today.
Doing it again today.
Yeah, it's a habit.
But I remember being terrified because I'm an only child. So you have to put this in context.
Go ahead.
I would come up here and I would pass up on particularly my right-hand side, and I'd see a load full of kids on the front steps, Now, I don't know whether they were going to school or whether they weren't or whether it was holiday time or what. This is my memory of these kids. And you never knew whether they were going to run after you or do something that you weren't used to. I had never seen anything like this. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely to come back and see what has happened to the street and what's happened to the people.
Yes, and they've done a lovely job in the house, haven't they?
It's remarkable.
It's fascinating. Mm. You say you're born in Wexford, and then you studied law in UCD, in Earlsford Terrace as it was then, and you became a solicitor. But you must have been one of the first female judges, were you?
I was the fifth, I think.
The fifth in the country. Were you in the district court?
I was in the district court.
Were you surprised to be made a judge, or...?
Well, it all happened by chance.
Yeah.
I met a solicitor on the street one day, and he said, they're looking for a woman to be a district judge.
Yes.
Why don't you apply? Now, I had done civil litigation always after I qualified. But I thought, how could I do that?
Yes.
But anyhow, I went home and I mentioned it to my about-to-be teenage children. And they said, why don't you go for it?
Good.
So I had to get a young solicitor to do my CV, because I didn't know what a CV was in those days.
Yeah, what year are we talking, roughly speaking?
We're talking about 1984.
In 1984.
And a bit like a documentary that was on RTE1 there some time ago.
Yes.
I got a phone call from a member of the government telling me that I was about to be appointed and there were two men going to be appointed with me.
Yes.
But that the government was withholding this appointment until they made certain that I wasn't going to sue my former husband.
Because they didn't want the...
They didn't want egg on their face.
They didn't want a to-do and egg on the face. Isn't that amazing?
I got very angry inside and I thought, well, stuff it. And then I thought, hang on a moment, who's going to be the loser? I am.
Yes.
And then I laughed and I said, well, I told the person at the other end of the phone, well, actually, that was done 10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah, came over.
Absolutely.
What's it like when you, if you want to take a sip, that you can buy one. What's it like when you have the authority and responsibility as a judge to incarcerate somebody or set them free? I often, when I watch a movie, I often wonder, that's an enormous... Oh, a burden almost, but it's a job.
It's a job, and you have to be. You just have to go for it, so to speak. There's nobody that doesn't make mistakes, but I have no apology to make for some of the people I put in prison. But prison to me is a last resort. If you can get little Johnny, as I call the accused people, and you can give that person a better life through maybe the probation service or some projects or whatever, we're all winners. The taxpayer is a winner.
Yeah.
Because I don't know whether the taxpayers realise the cost that they are paying to have little Johnny incarcerated for whatever length of time he would be incarcerated, or she would be. And really, isn't it much better to have somebody get a life together?
And how do you feel about nature versus nurture? Or do you think some people are born bad, or do you think they become bad?
I don't know. The jury is still out.
A good answer from you. Would you sway more one way than the other?
I would certainly sway in trying.
Yes.
And if at first you don't succeed, well, try again. And eventually you might say to yourself, you know, I'm sorry, but it's not working, so in you go.
When somebody like Michael Bambrick who murdered two women and buried them and comes up before you, what do you remember of him and looking at him?
I remember his eyes. He had the strangest eyes I ever saw. Frightening. I don't know whether he had any sort of disability or what. But then when you think of what he did, I really don't. I only put him through the court and read the book of evidence and... I didn't have to deal with him for very long, but certainly it's a memory I always have.
It stays with you. So you look in the whites of people's eyes then when you're sentencing or dealing with them. And can you read people? Do you believe you're reading people when you're looking at them?
I had one case shortly before I retired. And I couldn't tell you a thing about the victim who was sitting in the witness box. But I could tell you about the accused. And it was actually the first time that Father Tony Walsh, the singing priest, was convicted of sexual assault or whatever it was. And it was purely by watching him in the dock and his movements in the dock.
That
made me convict him.
What was he doing?
He had assaulted a young boy.
Yes.
After the young boy's grandfather's funeral in a pub up in Ballyfermot.
But what was he doing in the dock that was so...
His whole body language was telling me he was actually enjoying this young boy telling his story. I could never tell you a thing about that young boy, but I can tell you everything. And ironically, I laughed sometime after I retired. I was doing the commission for the sexual abuse by the clergy. Mm-hmm. I was chairing it, and I was in the solicitor's office, and this solicitor mentioned Tony Walsh. And I said, you know, I dealt with him. He said, yes, he said. And I have to say this to my credit. I love saying it, but it's the only time I ever heard it. He said, it was an inspired decision. And yeah. I looked at him and said, well, how do you know?
Yeah.
And he said, I was in the court, which, of course, thinking back, I should have realized he was. And I said to him, where were you? He said, I was at the back of the court. I said, that's the difference. I said, yeah. I saw what was going on in the dock. You didn't.
Brendan Smith.
I was on duty the night he was brought down.
He was one of the most gruesome...
Revolting man.
A revolting man.
Repulsive.
Explain that to me, if you could. I mean, I can hazard a guess why,
He sat there. I don't know. He sat there as if he slumped down. He'd no interest in being there. He was a man who definitely... he had a mind of his own. And I would say he hadn't an ounce of remorse for what he was doing.
Remarkable, isn't it?
And I believe going up and down in the prison van, if he saw young boys, he was quite disgusting.
It's repulsive, isn't it, thinking about people like that?
It's awful.
But you know something? We talked briefly before the show, and people like Richie Sadler and Sophia and even Chanel Miller over in America, who I spoke to yesterday, all young people in Ireland today talking freely about crimes like that in a way that possibly mightn't have been possible 10 years ago, 15 years ago,
but 20.
Pretty brave. And I don't think people, victims, like that word, by the way, so I'm reluctant to use it, but it is breathtaking that they are willing to come before us all and say, this happened. It's healthy is probably a better
it's
word.
It's healthy. And, you know, it's the sexual abuse crimes... They have been there long before I was around, and even when I look now and I see the mother and baby things and so on, how many years before they actually came to the surface? Mm. They were sure. There when I was a kid.
Yep.
Nobody ever knew about them, and nobody talked about them. And I mean, if I had gone home and told my parents that I had been abused, they wouldn't have believed me.
Yeah.
Nobody would have believed you in those days, but it's wonderful to see people having the guts, and it is guts.
You retired, and I got the sense, Gillian, that you might have been somewhat disillusioned. I mean, you said something along the lines of that you got fed up.
I did.
What were you fed up
with? I loved my job.
Did you?
I did. I loved my job. I could still feel like doing it.
Yes.
But first of all, my children were grown up. I had no dependents. I could not claim any dependents for tax purposes. Silly, but I fed up paying tax. Sure. And the second was, I'd been 17 years on the criminal side. And in that 17 years, I saw no improvement coming from the government in the criminal justice system. I'm now 17 years retired.
Yes.
And I'm still as sad as I was.
That's disappointing.
Very.
It's disappointing, but I love what you do with Tig Lynn and our friend Aubrey.
Aubrey,
and others.
Indeed. They're a wonderful, wonderful.
A wonderful bunch of people who take... I think they do something with the Johnny that you're talking about and friends, female and male, who feel they have no hope, and they bring them somewhere with a torch.
They do. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
And they stick at it.
They do. It's the resilience.
You know, and everybody, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
That's for sure. That's for sure. It's a great,
wonderful,
it's
wonderful
great place to support if people are in a position to do that. Gillian, thanks for coming to see us today.
Thank you indeed for having
me. Yeah, I always enjoy talking to you.
I must say, it's a privilege to be part of this.
Well, it's a privilege to have you as part of it.
It's a wonderful day for Henrietta Street.
Okay, well, thanks for saying so, and thanks for being here today. Really good to talk to you. Retired Judge Gillian Hussey joining us around the table here in 14 Henrietta Street at 8 minutes to 10. We've more to come. Loads of texts in on the different things we've been talking about today, 51551, and some guests are standing by to say hello. We'll get to them after this break. Well, my guest this morning at 28 minutes past nine began his film career with a letter to the award-winning film director Ken Loach, who told him to stop by for a cup of tea and a chat if he ever was in London. He did, and a working relationship went on to become one of the strongest and most prolific in cinema. The screenwriter Paul Laverty joins us, not for the first time. We were doing our maths. It's 13 years since we last spoke. Can you believe that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, in a window, in a shop window in Cork City.
for the window shoots the
barman. The very one.
Great memories. Great memories of Cork, great memories of that film. Yeah,
that film, we might as well, just as we're talking about, before we get stuck into the Sorry We Missed You, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, I think in some ways it started a movement in this country in terms of a time when we could actually look at the history of our island without the hysteria of paramilitary excess north of the border. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but what it led to was the hysteria of people like Gove, Michael Gove, who's now right at the heart of government.
Did he stuck into it?
Oh, he went absolutely crazy, absolutely bonkers when it won the Palme d'Or. And
did he say?
Well, basically what he said was, he stood history in its head and he got furious. I hadn't seen the film, but that didn't stop him writing about it. And basically it was interesting because he said, the Republicans have always, you know, had a peaceful way out, but they've always chosen the violent path. But what happened in The Wind That Shakes the Barley? 1918, Sinn Féin had a majority to leave the British Empire.
Yeah.
You know, we know the story there. They had a majority. They were repressed, led to the War of Independence. And he couldn't stand the fact that we reminded them of that democratic vote in 1918, and he just went furious. And then he went on to be Minister of Education. So there, it just shows you what type of people we've got at the heart of the British government. So you do well not to trust them, don't you?
Well, there you are. He's Minister for what, essentially Brexit or the Duchy of Lang or some other archaic expression. Yeah. In the London Times.
Some picture that, isn't it? Boris Johnson, Mogg, and Michael Gove. So you do well not to trust them.
Wouldn't you? In the London Times, I just see this piece from before. Gove questioned how British people could cheer for a director, as we were talking about there, Ken Loach, who portrays British soldiers as subhuman mercenaries burning thatched cottages, torturing by using pliers to rip out toenails and committing extreme violence against women.
Yeah, well,
or as we like to call it, the truth.
Yes, and this is the man who opposed the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
You know, and so the idea that these opportunists and mavericks, you know, are in the heart of government just now, I think that really must raise a warning sign. This is actually, you know, way transcends Brexit. Because if Johnson playing his Hollywood role just now, you know, like the Incredible Hulk, as he says, you know, pretending to be Rocky Balboa, lying his way through, backed by the popular press, and he presents himself as a hero. I mean, can you imagine the deals he'll do with the United States? I mean, we'll look at the corporate power already, the influence they have. Can you imagine him rolling out the red carpet? That's his words when he went over to the States. So I think we're coming up to a real big crisis, which totally transcends Brexit. And in fact, leads us very nicely onto our film, I think.
It does. Although you're giving me anxiety. Not that I don't do anxiety in any meaningful way, the way some people do, which is not easy for them. I get that entirely. But it's just, you know, look at the news this morning and we thought there was hope. And now the DUP have said they don't like what they see. Not a huge shock there, I suppose. But we would hope we're on the cusp of something. But it does lead back to your film that I saw yesterday. Sorry, we missed you. Do you want to give us the blurb at the back of the book? Would that allow us to get stuck into it?
Yes, well, I mean, first and foremost, Ryan, it's a story about a family, a very ordinary family who love each other. Mm. You know, as a mum, she's a care worker, and the father drives a white van. There's a teenage boy of 15 actually, and his sister Liza Jane, and so it's a very intimate story of how these four people live and interact, and how they don't really see their parents because, you know, the mum's in 0-hour contract. She goes out early in the morning to look after older people, then she has many hours free during the day. Then she does lunch for them, many hours free during the day again, for which she doesn't get paid, and then she does the tuck-ins at night time. And what you see is an extended working day, zero-hour contracts, very vulnerable, not being home with her children, and not getting paid for travel time. And no wonder, I don't know how it is here in Ireland, but there's a massive crisis right at the heart of care in the UK. And the more I travel around around Europe, just back from Paris as well, the other day there, talking to 1,100 activists, it's the same story again, precarious work. The father is a white van driver. And what has been wonderful about how this new liberal model works, it's so versatile and it's sculpted, you know, a kind of a framework where people believe that they are warriors, enterprise workers who believe they're in charge of their own business. They have their own vans. And Amazon is right at the heart of this, of course. And what it means is all risk is transferred from the company to the worker. So no holidays, no sick care. They bear the brunt if there's any accident. And again, so they believe that they're warriors of the road, you know, they're right at the heart of the enterprise culture. But what they're doing is carrying the burden, which, you know, a company should do. So what we see is people being, you know, in precarious work, tied to an app, incredible control over their own lives. And before you know it, you don't see your own children, which in the film really begs the question, what is the point of work if you can't actually see your own children? And in the old days, you know, we are of a generation who remember if somebody actually worked, they might not be rich, but at least, you know, you could plan your life, there was some security. But now what was really fascinating, and this is what we found out after, we went around the food banks for I, Daniel Blake, the amount of the working poor was really unbelievable who were going to the food banks. And now the statistics have backed this out. 3 out of 4 children in poverty in the UK have at least one working parent. So that old contract where you worked and got yourself out of poverty no longer exists. So I think there's a massive existential crisis right at the heart of the workplace just now.
Okay, you've covered a multitude there. And within the film, let us go to focus on let's say the wife in this piece. Yes. Mm-hmm. She's the care worker.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Kindness coming from every cell in her body. She's a kind person. The way she treats the older people she's looking after, even if they're getting in their senility cruel, nasty and loud, if they're knocking plates onto the ground, if she has to change the nappies and so forth. Mm. And so forth. And she's on the bus because she had to sell the car in order for the husband to buy the white van. It's relentless. I noticed that almost like the supporting cast are the bags under the eyes of the lead roles. Yeah. Do you know what I mean by that? They're so tired and so weary and yet loving.
Well, I mean, it's really fascinating, Ryan. I'm glad you picked up on that, really, because, you know, obviously that there's a crisis in care work and you hear horror stories, you know, when I did the research.
Mm.
But talking to the carers, these people were not doing it for money. I met some absolutely remarkable, it was mostly women, absolutely brilliant women. You know, and I said, well, I try to treat them as I would my mother.
Yeah, it says,
you know,
that. Yeah,
yeah, and that's a line from a carer.
You'd never leave your mother in a situation like that, and therefore,
And they were incredible. And the dedication, they said, you know, not only that, and they were furious at their own bosses because they would change staff and people who are older and easily confused or have got dementia or pre-dementia, you know, being confused by a different face. They say, no, they've got the right to see the same face. You know, and so that's the workers are saying, like, I know my work, and it's an incredibly complex job. All the medicines, the patients, cleaning them. Some people have got wounds, you know. And so I found really remarkable, brilliant people doing this. And then, of course, you heard of terrible horror stories too.
Yes.
You know, people left on their own, the central heat not turned on, people doubly incontinent, you know, being forgotten about, you know, because, you know, the system just does not work. It's all subcontracted. Many have been taken over by equity funds. And so what you see is a system that doesn't work.
Let's go to the main man, as it were, which is Ricky Turner, played by Chris Hitchin. So from the get-go, as soon as I saw him in the garage looking to buy the forecourt to buy the white van, I knew he was doomed because I've seen your movies. This is not a happy ending material, right? So I knew, and I saw the...
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
The next one's a comedy, I swear, Ryan.
Someday, we'll get to that. Spoiler alert, Paul wrote it.
I think there's a few moments of mirth in it. Yeah.
Oh, crikey, tell me where they were. I missed them. We go into what I was like. But when I saw the prices in the window of the car, of the vans, I thought, okay, now we're into 14 grand, 13 grand. But he goes to the warehouse and the boss man, the big fella, turns around essentially
And says, here's your, what's that machine that they have?
Well, they call it a gun or a scanner, a handheld device.
Right, so you see delivery people come to your house, your office, and they have the scanner. And that's their lifeline to the central system.
Yes.
And your man essentially says to him, you lose this, you're dead. You miss a turn, you're dead. You miss a delivery, you're dead. Mm. You don't miss. And then one of his colleagues hands him a plastic bottle, empty bottle, and says, take that. What do I need this for? That's your toilet break. Like stark. And now from the get-go then, he's the running man. Yeah. He can't breathe or take a moment or worry about his family. We'll get to that in a second. It's relentless. And well, that's the gig economy.
Well, you can only write that, Ryan, because I've been with them.
Yeah.
You know, and it was actually, even for Daniel Blake, I found whistleblowers inside the Department of Welfare. It was easier to do that. For this film, it was much harder because these people are working so hard, so long hours, they're in a van, they're driving about, and they're exhausted. Mm. So actually to find them and to speak to them and to spend time with them was really difficult. So eventually I just went to depots, I went to car parks, and I went early in the morning and I came back and I spoke to them afterwards. And then I started speaking to them. Then I got to know some of them. Some of them were kind enough and brave enough to let me come with them. So I did the parcels with them. So if you spend a day with someone who's on the run the whole time, then you see the plastic bottle, you know? I mean, I remember one lad actually bought him his lunch, a couple of sandwiches, you know? And he was surviving on high-energy drinks, and he simply didn't have time to eat a sandwich because the thing was bleeping, he had to hit his preciser. If you don't get your precisers, you get penalty points, you know? And so when you see that man at the end of his day, and you can see the greyness in his eye, and then, you know, all sorts of complications take place. You know, over in some places with airports flying over, a plane will maybe do something to the connection with his handheld device. Or there's a delay, or there's a road, or there's an accident, or somebody's not in, or somebody doesn't do something else, or somebody complains. And you just see them just being pounded and pounded and pounded. And then you see the photographs of their kids, you know, stuck to the, you know, the front bench of their van. You know, and then you speak to them, well, when did you see them? You know, and he's rushing to get back maybe in time, you know. And then it's the devil is always in the detail.
Yes.
Talk to one Amazon driver. He says, you know, Amazon will tell you they book on at such and such a time. They'll show the technology. When you go in with him and you speak to him, no, I've got to be in. I've got to leave at such and such an hour to avoid the traffic. I've got to be in the holding car park 2 hours before so I go out in the first wave. You know, all of that unpaid.
And you want to get the right route.
And the right route. And then the changes. And, you know, so no wonder Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. In fact, actually, I showed one of the drivers by some strange quirk of fate. The newspaper came, it was a change in shares, and he overtook Bill Gates as the richest man in the world. And this guy was running around sweating. His face was, you know, he was grey with tiredness. Yeah. I said, do you know who that is? Jeff Bezos. And, you know, and he's the richest man in the world. And you can just see this man saying, right, the penny dropped. You know, he's monitoring every single second, tied to an algorithm, you know, to make profit. And no wonder, this is amazing, Ryan. I bought the New York Times just yesterday in the plane. They're talking about capitalism being in a crisis. 2 weeks ago, the Financial Times had a big front page supplement stuck to their paper because they say the inequality in this neoliberal system just now, you know, might bring the whole thing down. So they're saying, let's regulate it. You know, let's tame it. Let's try and humanise it. But of course, I mean, that's like trying to tame a tiger.
But wouldn't you love to put Jeff Bezos in a van for a day and say, because just to that, I'm not trying to do an anti-Bezos. I don't have an opinion on this. But I'm just saying that if he got a whiff of the, you know, the urine stained bottle and the pressure, the half a sandwich, I wonder would he go, oh, we need to change, because I'm sure he's not a bad guy, but he needs to be in the inside of that van.
Well, I would love to give him and his executives a plastic bottle and tie them up inside their executive office and say, okay, no toilet breaks for you, mate. Yeah. You know, because you're mathematicians, you're algorithm experts, you're information technologists. Monitor the moments and the steps of every single one of your hundreds of thousands of workers. And surprise, surprise, do they have toilet breaks? No, they don't.
Well, this
I would take issue. This man knows. He knows how to make money. He's got to win the competition. It's in the nature of the beast. And that's why I think it can't be tamed. And now I really think we're coming to the... we're talking about climate change. I mean, how mad can it be that we're having vapes and shirts and T-shirts and socks being delivered by one exploited driver in a white van all around our... I mean, it's happening in the States. It's happening all around Europe.
Yeah.
It's mad. So I think we have to say, no, this market system does not work. Now, we let them off in 2008. It was a financial crisis. They're back to doing their same tricks. They're giving out bigger bonuses than they've ever done before. Eight people now own the same as 50% of the world's population. Yeah. And I think people have to say, no, you're not doing this to our families. You're not doing this to our communities. So I think it really begs the question, how do we take back power? How do we change the plan of ownership? And we can't let them away with it. Abby at the end of the film goes, how do you get away with it?
Yes.
You know, and that's what they're fearful of too. That's what the Financial Times is scared of. That's what the New York Times is scared of. Mm-hmm. And we are far too conservative, far too fearful. And we have to get together with our young people who are showing brilliant example of militancy because their lives have been screwed. They've been given, they can't buy their houses, they can't have serious work, they can't build their families. Yeah. And I'm hearing these stories all around Europe. Mm. And there really is a time now to say, right, no more. We are going to use our imagination. We're going to find new ways of dealing with our economy so we have control of it and we're not dictated and sending all that money back to the States. And these bandits never even pay their taxes. And you know that about in Ireland more than anyone.
Well, that's another discussion, no question.
A very good one. About time you paid up. And what's the government? I mean, it's like a Monty Python scene. They're appealing a decision of taxes going to, you know, European taxpayers. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like something out of the Life of Brian.
Well, it does seem, you know, who's answerable? It feels like the adults have left the room in the world at the moment. I don't know where anyone is or who's in charge. And if you, for example, if you look at Twitter or Facebook or these kind of places, they kind of seem to operate a little bit in the shadows. It's hard to find responsibility, or at least they'll say, print everything. Kids are being bullied, people are being shamed, and it's very hard to find out who's going to take responsibility. But before we talk about any more of that, let me ask you about the children in the film. There's a young, there's a teenage boy who is going off the rails because, again, there's no, dare I say it, adult in the room because they're working their backsides off. There's the young girl, she's 11 years old, who becomes the carer, essentially. Who cares for the carer? Mm. The answer is the daughter, because she comes in from school, she's making her cereal or whatever, she's listening to the muffled rows that are born out of exhaustion, not out of hate.
Thanks, Ryan. I think that's really perceptive, really. And I think this little kid, you know, is really special. I mean, she was special in my imagination, you know, when she came to mind, but we found little Katie. And she, I mean, she was just a remarkable child.
Really?
So smart. She was top of the class for absolutely everything. I mean, she could turn her hand to anything. And she had a kind of an emotional kind of connection with people. And so we were so lucky to find her and the young lad, Reese. But you're right. I mean, I think she's actually much more emotionally intelligent than her father, for example. You know, and she's seen all the arguments. You know, she's saying that people are tired. She comes back in and, you know, she sees her mum and dad exhausted in front of the television with a takeaway meal. And she starts putting things away.
At 11 p.m.
Yeah, 11.
School the next day. Yeah,
school the next day. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, she's a brilliant kid, you know, and she's going to be good at her homework. But why are we doing this to our kids? I mean, this is not an accident. This is the tail end of, you know, of a gig economy where trade unions have been wiped out. Where there's been massive privatisation of absolutely everything, and at the very tail end of it, we see how this plays out, you know, with zero-hour contracts in the lives of one delicate family.
Yes.
And this is a family that loves each other. I mean, in another, they haven't got problems. So you can imagine families who've got a little, you know, other problems to deal with, health or mental health. I mean, they are going to be absolutely decimated and destroyed. But this is a family that loves each other, and this is the consequence and the logic of a system that really destroys people's lives.
There's an expression we use a lot in the programme, which is about you never know who you're sitting beside on the bus. You know, you just never know, or the cranky person who won't let you out in front of them in the car or whatever. You should give them the benefit of the doubt that they might be having a terrible day, there could be something wrong. And then, if not, they're just rude, and that's unfortunate. My point being, I suppose, that when a white van comes outside your door, when Just Eat or Deliveroo are bringing in your latest curry or whatever it might be, you probably have to second guess. I'm not having a go at the firms. I'm just saying, in terms of humanity, the person handing you that the goods over, we need to, as humans, be engaging and be kind and say thank you for that, or maybe even say, where are you from, or what are you up to, and that kind of thing. It might sound patronising, but I actually mean, I want to get back to what I said at the beginning of the programme, civil discourse.
Yes,
it's got to be a start.
The great problem is, if you engage them, because the system is so stacked up against them, you know, just that ordinary discourse eats into their time and they're under even more pressure.
That's
the thing. But you're right. I think the next step, Ryan, is to have curiosity about people's lives and what's happening and, you know, how they're operating and how they're being paid.
Yeah.
You know, and the same for our carers. You know, I met brilliant carers, you know, who couldn't afford to continue with their job because they had to pay for their own travel, 0 hour contracts. So many families in need with an old parent are losing great carers because they can't afford to do this job. So, I mean, I think we need to have civic curiosity.
Yeah, I love that expression and I agree with you. A text says, tell youngsters, I don't know why I say youngsters, tell everyone, but to stop buying online because they're wrecking things for themselves and soon there'll be no shops and no real jobs. I mean, there is that danger. That local shop is closing. I mean, you see it all around towns and villages in Ireland. I'm not sure if it's the same in Scotland or the UK broadly speaking. And yet you don't want to be necessarily a dinosaur or, you know, you don't want to be out of step with the times. So it's a balance, is it?
Ryan, I mean, it's a very good point and a good point by your caller, really. I've just gone round the northeast of England just very recently. You know, you go and see the town centres, they are dead. The libraries are closing, the churches are closing, all the community centres are closing. All this was after austerity. The pubs are closing. Places where people meet are closing. All the projects for youngsters are closing. And then they're surprised at knife crime in the UK when all the civic infrastructure is drawn away because they're leaving it again to the market.
Paulus.
The market does not work. And unless we challenge that paradigm, we are screwed and it's going to destroy our communities and the lives of tens of millions of our citizens.
Paula says, I was at a meeting last night concerning low pay in the hospitality sector, which I know you talk to people in that sector with regard to this film. And some of the horror stories, she says, I listened to were so sad, mostly non-Irish, women mostly, again, abused by the bosses. She asks, what have we become? Kath says, are the younger population not the worst offenders in consumerism, online shopping and lack of knowledge or concern for poorer children enslaved and being exploited? And then again, I would argue that it's not just younger population. I think it's wholesale. Another from a text says, my son has a good job with a multinational, well paid, but his working conditions are not far from those of a member of the gig economy. He never knocks off work, sees little of his children and is under constant stress. He travels abroad for work, but is never compensated for his travel time. And I worry about the effects on his health and his relationship with his family. It is a dark time for workers.
I mean, you can see again that anxiousness everywhere. I mean, the stories here in Ireland, the stories are here in the UK.
Yeah.
We were in France there. We talked to 1,100 activists just to say the other night there. And it's the same story.
It's universal.
It's precariousness. Mm. They're frightened. The unions have been destroyed.
Yeah.
Everything is on their terms. You know, you're at the end of a telephone, whether you get work on a telephone, shows you a dinosaur arm. You know, a text, whether you get a job the next day. People are frightened and isolated. You know, and now we have this system now which extracts so much surplus from the economy. And there's such inequality. And so there's only one way to deal with that is to take power back from them. Frederick Douglass, the great slave, he said, power concedes nothing without demand. It never did and it never will. You know, so it's all right. We can change our shopping patterns. It's going to, you know, just piss around the edges. We have to go back to radical questions. Communities have to demand of their politicians that they're brave and we have an imaginative solutions to taking back control out of our economies. Because if we don't do that, all we'll do is we'll just be complaining.
Well, interesting you should mention Frederick Douglass, who, of course, had great time for Daniel O'Connell,
who we knew
as the liberator. Maybe it's time to liberate ourselves from
liberate our minds first, because I think, you know, questions and narratives are in our minds. Margaret Thatcher was a genius. Her and Nicholas Ridley and Keith Joseph, they sold they stole the narrative. We must be independent. We must look after our families. You know, it's all about free choice.
Yeah.
And now we have to say we're all in this together. Our communities have to take back control. We have to find new narratives and new stories. And we have to have confidence and we have to trust our young people and their brilliant way of finding new ways to take control of our lives again. Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to be screwed.
I'm laughing, thinking in a sardonic way, I suppose, how two guests I've spoken to recently singing the praises of Mrs. Thatcher.
Oh, I don't sing her praises.
No, I know that you don't.
Yes,
But I'm just showing the nature of the world we live in.
Yes, and if only the left were as radical and as clear-sighted
as the right.
As the right were, because Johnson will bury so many people if he takes control, and he'll be doing deals with his friends across the Atlantic, and you'll see more misery and more complaints like that.
Well, there you are. The two names I'm mentioning were Jeffrey Archer and John Bercow in the last 2 weeks. So there you are. That's it. You have your own civil war going on in the
UK, I think.
But just going to say one thing too, Ryan, because people always, I'm not a member of the Labour Party, but I was at the Labour Party conference presenting our film. And actually, there's some great new things going on there, but we don't hear about, taking back control of utilities, which is actually very, very popular, according to the opinion polls. Giving trade unions back their rights. And Corbyn has been absolutely decimated and attacked because I think capital realises that him and John McDonald are a danger to corporate power. And I think that's why there's such vicious attacks against him.
Interesting times, to say the very least. Yeah. Your film, Sorry We Missed You, written by yourself, directed by Ken Loach, the word I'd use is devastating. It got right under my skin. And I think that's where you want your films to be. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on
Thanks,
that.
Ryan.
I really enjoyed seeing you again. Don't leave it so long. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Likewise.
Tomorrow's Friday. So it's Friday, 2 or 3 weeks. It's the 1st of November.
Yes.
Is the film will be released here. Aye. And it is, as I say, it's a salutary tale for our times. Grim, but necessary. Paul Laverty, thanks for your time today.
Great pleasure, Ryan. Thank you.
Thank you.